John, tell me what's on your mind. You got
a
question?
No, we got to do a little welcomey.
Welcome, everybody, to a breaking news episode of Evidence Squared. The breaking news is that we're actually producing more episodes for once.
Are we going with the F-bomb, are we?
We know the surface temperature of the Earth is warming.
Human activities are changing the atmosphere.
Simple, clear messages, repeated often by a variety of trusted voices.
It is time to forget about the old way of talking about climate change.
I really believe it's the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
Welcome, everybody, to a mini episode of Evidence Squared. My name is Peter Jacobs.
I'm John Cook.
And we are here just to provide a little context with a story that was making the rounds in the news recently.
Yeah, so, you know, my profession is climate communication, and so I like to keep track of what people are saying about climate change, particularly climate scientists, who are usually the main voice of climate change to the general public. And there's this paper that's just come out in Nature Geoscience, and it's being spun in newspapers as if climate scientists are admitting that they've got everything wrong, that they've been exaggerating global warming all this time. It's all a big blowout and we can stop worrying about climate change. What's going on here with the climate scientists, Peter?
Yeah, well, so this, I would call this an incredible communications own goal. So it's worth kind of probably breaking this into a few different pieces. Number one is, you know, we should be clear up front that this isn't the entirety of the press coverage. There was some actual, you know, normal, relatively sane, decent press coverage. And that kind of focused on the idea that, you know, if we want to keep warming limited to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average, then there is still time to do that if we started basically cutting emissions to zero now.
And this is based on a study that's just come out in Nature Geoscience.
Right. I think it's Richard Millar is the lead author, and several other authors, some of whom are amazing scientists. That's what you would expect would be a good paper, certainly not the kind of social media frenzy that we have seen, which is driven by the other part of the media coverage, which is basically what you described, and that I feel like kind of took off in the what we call the UK tabloid press, which is sort of a very, very politically right wing and also very hostile to climate science environment, and they routinely kind of misconstrue papers and, you know, make outrageous claims and cite a study when the study says nothing of the kind.
I mean, it's worth pointing out that the main article that has exaggerated or misrepresented this study comes from the Breitbart website and was written by James Dellingpole.
Right, and on the UK side, it was in like the Sun, which is the it's like Fox. If Fox News was a newspaper, that would be the Sun in the UK. It is got a very strong slant, and I think the headline it ran under, but it's the biggest newspaper in the UK, and I think the headline was something like CO2 con. So, I mean, just absolutely, how do you get from, you know, point A to point B is something that we can talk about. But I think it's worth kind of just considering, you know, to me, was this a sort of a preventable episode? And I think it was. I think there was a problem with the way that the paper's results were presented to some news outlets. Some of the authors kind of said some things off the cuff that actually were just factually not true. And there was maybe a line or two within a very large paper with quite extensive supplementary material. There was like maybe one line that could have been written a little bit better. But basically this, you know, one quote given to one news outlet by one of the authors in an interview and one line in the paper were sort of spun into this giant conspiracy revealed.
Theory, yeah.
So you get the, you know, the regular mainstream media saying, hey, here's this climate science paper. It's got good news. There's still time to limit warming to this certain amount, you know, based on assumptions made in this paper. And then there's this whole other universe that is saying, oh, you know, climate scientists were wrong. They've been wrong. They've been exaggerating. The models are wrong. Blah, 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 blah. So
I feel loath to blame climate scientists because it seems like unless they get every single punctuation mark and word framed exactly perfectly, it's going to be spun into a giant conspiracy theory disproving all of climate science.
I mean, I feel like that's fair to a certain extent. And then there's kind of a corollary to that, which is to say, you know, do we even need to worry about this sort of denialosphere echo chamber of the media? And I think both of those things are actually worth, you know, pushing back on. I'm not going to defend the climate scientists in this scenario. I think they actually deserve a little bit of chastisement. So number one, I don't think you can write off sort of that entire branch of the media wholesale, because that, you know, that speaks to essentially half the population, or at least half the voting population in the United States. And I assume it's, you know, based on stuff like Brexit, it's probably about half in the UK as well. So like, you can't just say, yeah, they always get the stuff wrong. Yeah. They're always saying these things. That's not a good excuse. You know, like that for better or for worse, that is half the country is mainlining these, you know, completely ridiculous frames. So,
and even if it wasn't a very large number of people amongst the general public reading these types of newspapers, often it matters who reads
it.
So, for example, in Australia, the Fox News newspaper equivalent is a newspaper called The Australian.
And it doesn't have much of an imaginative title.
Yeah, well, they try to brand themselves as the, the national paper of record. And it's not read by a huge readership, but it's read by important, influential people, and that matters.
Right. So that would be kind of almost like the Wall Street Journal functions in the U.S., where not a huge circulation, but certainly very important to especially kind of key people on the political right. So, and then the second part of what you said is like, you're loath to blame climate scientists because if they don't, you know, kind of dot every I and cross every T, I, in this case, I absolutely don't think that that's the explanation. So, I don't feel like naming any names, but you know, if people want to dig into this, they can figure this all out. But what basically one of the authors gave a direct quote to a reporter saying, you know, the climate models said we should see like this rapid acceleration of warming after the year 2000, and the observations just don't show that. And that formed the basis of a lot of these stories. And it's factually false kind of on both fronts. There is no rapid, you know, and there's no big inflection point that we should have expected to have seen. Number one. Number two, the observations continue to show, you know, that there is a lot of, you know, 2015 was the warmest year on record. Then 2016 was even warmer. There's a big, you know, we can talk about the nitty gritty of comparing climate models to observations and whether that's actually an easy thing to talk about or not a little bit later. But the point is this, this was a scientifically indefensible claim, but it was made by one of the authors of the study to a reporter. So you can't just say Breitbart, nothing we can do about it. If one of the authors is saying things that just, it's like handing them a loaded gun. And so in this instance, I think there is some blame to go directly at the climate scientists. So what's the lesson from communications about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure, and I would probably think that trying to encourage better media literacy amongst climate scientists is one of the solutions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard in this case, but because it's not like you can blame a naive, inexperienced person. This person has been around for a while. They have experience talking to the press. They know the political environment that they're operating in. But I think what it means is that if you are talking to a journalist on the record, about things, just be sure of your own facts. You can't, don't wing it. Don't try to speak off the cuff about stuff that's kind of related to what your work is about. That's not. And at the risk of getting it wrong and then, you know, basically igniting a firestorm of controversy when, you know, you can't really actually be speaking to the thing that you're talking to the reporter about, because it's beyond the scope of what you actually worked on.
So what about, I don't know if this is a little off topic, but what about the actual paper, just from a, not from a communication point of view, but from a climate science point of view? How does that paper fit in amongst the pantheon of studies that have looked at climate models compared to observations?
So I don't want to, you know, slag this paper. I think it tried to do something interesting. And I think that, you know, you can certainly get some, there is value to be had from reading the paper, trying to understand what it's saying, whether you agree or disagree with the results. It's not wrong on its face. They make several assumptions that I think are, they kind of stack several assumptions on top of each other that lead to a primary conclusion, which is that there is still time to, you know, reach this specific temperature target. If you're trying to hold warming to this certain level, previous studies have found, you know, basically there's no time left. We can't reach this goal. They say, actually, there is still time left. The bottom line in terms of a science point is that there's enough uncertainty in, you know, what is called the carbon budget, or how much fossil fuel we can still burn, and uncertainty in the sensitivity of the climate to added CO2, that we can't say probably that there is no time left. So basically they just said, kind of under, if you make these sort of optimistic assumptions, then we can still make it. And I think that's not wrong on its face. But what they basically did was they used, you know, a temperature record that did not show as much warming as other temperature records. They compared, you know, a certain subset of models with that, you know, slightly cooler temperature record, rather than sort of all of the models that you would use if you were really trying to say, do climate models show the same amount of warming as the temperature record? And so it's kind of like little by little, these assumptions sort of add up. And, you know, in terms of the top line claim, do we still have time to avoid this threshold? You know, maybe we do. But in terms of does the analysis that they performed support the sort of nested little one line in the paper that, you know, kind of says something to the effect that the temperature was not rising basically as fast as the climate models would imply they should to a given amount of CO2, that is not defensible at all. I think, you know, in hindsight, they probably wouldn't have phrased it the way they did. But that really wasn't the point of their paper. So they probably weren't paying a lot of attention to the wording of that, I would assume. And so then that leads naturally into the question of like, how do you really say, how do you assess, are we warming up as much as climate models say we should be? And what does that present in terms of challenges from a communication standpoint?
Would you say this is an accurate kind of characterization of the research then? Different scientific teams are looking at the question of the 1.5 degree threshold. Some would say we've already passed it, it's too late. Others would say we've got 10, 20 years. But there's that spectrum of results from already passed it to, you know, we've got a little bit of time left. But the Breitbart interpretation of, is, therefore, because of that uncertainty or that those range of values, we can't trust any of it. So let's just, go business as usual. Would that be a fair assessment of the situation?
Right. It's an insane leap. So it would be like, if you were saying, you know, I want to try to you know, save a certain amount of money. If you're a kid trying to save for a bicycle before your next birthday and you kind of have like an idea about how much of your allowance you can save, how much money you could earn mowing lawns or whatever. And you're like, you know, if I keep saving, I keep putting away at such and such a rate, you know, like I'll either have enough money to buy the bike before my birthday or I won't. And so there's some question, you know, can you do it? Can you not do it? This is like then denying that there's any, like then somebody saying, because maybe you won't be able to kind of save enough to quite get enough money to buy the bike in time for your birthday. That means you have zero allowance. It means your allowance is a myth. Like it's an insane non sequitur.
Mm. How about this analogy? Let me propose a different analogy.
Yeah, that was a terrible analogy. You go.
How about the house is on fire and the fireman is saying your house will completely burn down in 1 hour, and another fireman says, I think it'll burn down in 2 hours. And your response is, oh, well, if you're not sure, I'm just going to throw some lighter fluid on the house.
Right. Yeah. No, that's good. That's better. That's a lot more visual. you know, and I mean, I think that it's important to just to, you know, I don't want to be a nitpicker, but like the question is, we have not warmed 1.5 degrees already. The question is there time enough to sort of change the way we use energy and how much, you know, fossil fuel we will consume in the future? Do we still have time to sort of ramp down our carbon intensive world before we hit that mark? Not that it's too late because we've already warmed up that much, but do we still have time to sort of get on the off ramp before we go past that exit?
And one last thing I think I'd like to point out is I'm a little bit uncomfortable with this kind of binary threshold which climate change is so often framed, whether it's almost we will keep it under 1.5 and we're safe versus if it's too late and we go over 1.5, all is lost. Like, even if we do go over 1.5, what we do matters, because 3 degrees is a lot different to 5 degrees warming. And it's really a matter of degrees, and every bit of action now will reduce the impacts that we face in the future.
Right. I mean, any sort of mitigation of fossil fuel is better than none. So like any action we take is better than none. If we don't beat that 1.5 degree goal, that doesn't mean give up. You know, there's a reason why people kind of throw
that framing does breed a degree of fatalism or can even
it does. I mean,
people.
I agree with you. I see that in, you know, we do, you and I have done Reddit Ask Me Anythings, and you will see occasionally in those Q&As, somebody will ask a question about if we still have time, and somebody else will come in and be like, no, you know, the limit is 2 degrees or the limit is 1.5 degrees and it's already too late. So like, it's game over. And like that sort of binary thinking is false. It's absolutely not true. And to the extent that it can become like a paralyzing or a disempowering force, I think that's troublesome. And I question whether we should be doing it. However, to take a different look, I mean, you know, from psychological research that giving people sort of concrete targets to hit is actually really helpful in terms of motivation and concretizing something that might seem a little bit abstract. So I think that there's a trade-off in whether the ultimate impact of setting up a threshold that we may or may not meet is more disempowering than it is motivating, I think is something that is a wide open area for social science research.
It's a complicated question because, yeah, it's a two-edged sword. It can help motivate, but it could also demotivate, and whether it does one or the other will probably depend on the direction that society goes in over the next few decades or the next few years even.
Right. So I guess the final piece of this is just, you know, why is it not an easier question to answer? Or if Breitbart says, or if one of the authors of the paper say something like, you know, the climate models say we should have warmed a lot by this time and the temperature actually didn't, that is an empirically resolvable question. It should be very kind of, you know, is that true? Is that not true? Why is it not more straightforward to answer? And that gets into all of these questions of, you know, what actually, how do we construct a temperature record and blah, blah, blah. You know, like what are the, what we call forcings that you put into the climate models and all of these different things. I think the very simple way to answer the question is that if you think about, and I offered this analogy to Zeke Housefather. I don't know if he actually used it or not in his carbon brief, write up of this whole story, which I recommend people read. But basically it's like if you give somebody a chocolate chip cookie and then you give them an oatmeal raisin cookie and somebody says, oh my God, this oatmeal raisin cookie, it tastes nothing like the chocolate chip cookie. Well, like, yeah, no kidding. It's a different cookie. You baked it a different way. You used different ingredients. So the question is, if you compare the climate models to the observations in such a way that you're using the same recipe, using the same cooking techniques, you're using the same ingredients, do they agree or do they not agree? And they do. They very, very, very much agree. So claims that, you know, we're not warming as much as we should be are absolutely false. But the problem is people don't really make a like for like comparison a lot of times. And so you can misleadingly, you know, either from good faith or in bad faith, come to the conclusion that climate models are showing more warming than we've seen, when in fact that's because you're not doing a like for like comparison.
So the other factor, though, is that when you have bad faith actors in the situation who are always looking for opportunities to distort the research, it's very easy for them to, even if they don't find appropriate scientific comparisons, to make their own apples to oranges comparisons in order to distort the science or misrepresent the role of uncertainty. There's just a lot. When you have complicated scientific issues like climate change, there's just a lot of little chinks in the armor that people can exploit in order to confuse the public.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's basically, it can get down to something as simple as like how to lie with statistics.
So I guess one, climate scientists and science communicators need to, follow, you know, sound evidence-based approaches to how they communicate the science. But they also have to be aware of how science communication and scientific results can be distorted as well and proactively avoid those kind of outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I think your goal, if you're already talking to a reporter about your science, presumably you want people to understand your science. Presumably you want people to be excited. You want people to read. You want people to understand what you're doing. So if your goal is to say, this is the message of my paper, you know, make sure you know what you're trying to say. Say it clearly. Don't go off on tangents. And then the result being that people are reporting on stuff that had nothing to do with the conclusions of your paper. So a little bit of discipline, a little bit of, you know, making sure you actually speak to the subject matter at hand, I think goes a long way. And also, you know, I think that to a little bit more what you were suggesting is like be cognizant of the communications environment you're operating in. If there are, you know, political or ideological or, you know, sort of other factors involved that up the chances for people misunderstanding you intentionally or unintentionally, you know, be wary of those too. So here, this is a question, you know, how do you apportion blame on a communications, giant communications snafu like this? I don't know that apportioning blame is necessarily productive, but I do think that, I think a mistake could be made in writing this off as like the inevitable consequence of a slanted, you know, media and the inevitable consequence of a hostile, you know, group of people working against your chosen field. I do think that there is some responsibility that scientists have, when they choose to enter the communications world, in being evidence-based and solid in how they communicate.
Communication is like extreme weather. Like you can load the dice to go in certain directions, right? So
right.
If you are ill-disciplined, then I guess you do increase
the chances. We can't attribute any one terrible Breitbart story.
That's right. Things can always go pear-shaped one way or the other, but you increase your chances of having good communication outcomes if you follow sound principles.
Right. Right. It certainly doesn't help when you say something that's completely factually inaccurate to a hostile reporter.
Okay. Well, I think that covers that topic well. We've got a couple of episodes coming up, and I'm going to describe what they are now just to put the pressure on myself to make sure that I do deliver them. We do have some really interesting interviews in the can. We spoke to Baruch Fischoff, the science communication expert, quite a while ago, and so that episode will be coming soon. But I've also spoke to Jim Gandy when I was at a meteorologist conference. Jim Gandy is a TV meteorologist who did some of the pioneering work with George Mason of weathercasters on TV talking about climate change. They did a pilot study where he talked about climate change, and then they measured the impact of his climate communication on the local public. So fascinating conversation with Jim. He's a great communicator. And also I visited the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in LA not that long ago. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to talk to Josh Willis, who is a climate scientist, done some really important work on ocean heat content, but he's also a stand-up comedian, and he's done a lot of work, like creative work with online videos and puppet shows and comedy skits and stand-up comedy. And so I talked to him about climate communication and comedy. So those three episodes will be coming up soon.
Well, I can't wait to hear the finished product. And I know, I don't know if you saw, but I had a little back and forth with Graham Redfern on Twitter, because he had a little bit of a lull in his great podcast, Positive Feedback, and we were making some hiatus jokes between the two of us. So, as always, you can catch there's links to things that we talked about. So I want to just reiterate, there's a good maybe a couple articles on Carbon Brief written by Zeke Hausfather about this topic. Stefan Rahmstorf also just wrote something today on Real Climate. If you kind of want to understand the paper a little bit better, those are great places. And I think also Climate Feedback did an analysis of one of the sort of an example of one of the misleading pieces. Like, I don't know if it was the Breitbart one or not, but they sort of showed why that was why it was wrong.
While I'm editing together this video, I assume that you'll be putting all those links into the show notes on evidencesquared.com.
evidencesquared.com, and you can email me at peter@evidencesquared.com. You can email john@evidencesquared.com.
Get to say my own email address now?
I felt like I wanted it done right, so I'd just do it. You can find us on Twitter @evidencesquared.
You can find us on Facebook @evidencesquared. I got to get in to the outro at some point. Sorry to interrupt.
What should people do if they want to find our podcast?
Well, they can get onto iTunes and search for Evidence Squared. And once they found us, subscribe and rate us and review us.
And then I guess that does it for us. We look forward to breaking out some new episodes in the near future.
See you later. Anything else you want to get off your chest?
That was a little rude.
You're out of practice. You've forgotten what this podcast was like.
Yeah, I did forget.